It was the movie that changed movies. It terrified and thrilled countless millions worldwide and inspired a whole new generation of filmmakers. And it launched the career of one of the most successful directors in the history of the medium. Released on June 20th, 1975, Steven Spielberg's Jaws hit the world like a tidal wave and introduced the notion of the blockbuster into the public consciousness. Now, this landmark film makes its debut on gorgeous high-definition Blu-ray, following a painstaking restoration process, and a package which also includes a brand new documentary titled The Shark Is Still Working that traces the history of the production and the ultimate legacy of the film. In this special episode of Movie Geeks United, we celebrate the release of the Blu-ray with two interview segments, with Jaws screenwriter and actor Carl Gottlieb, and with three key members of the Shark Is Still Working team, director Eric Hollander, producer James Gillette, and co-producer and composer Michael McCormick.
Y'all know me, know how I earn a living. I'll catch this bird for you, but it ain't gonna be easy. It's bad fish. Not like going down the pond chasing bluegills or tommy cats. This shark, swallow you whole. Shaking, tenderizing, down you go. Now we gotta do it quick. That'll bring back the tourists. That'll put all your businesses on a paying basis. But it's not gonna be pleasant. I value my neck a lot more than $3,000, Chief. I'll fine him for three, but I'll catch him and kill him for 10. And you gotta make up your minds. You wanna stay alive and ante up? You wanna play it cheap? Be on welfare the whole winter. I don't want no volunteers. I don't want no mates. There's too many captains on this island. $10,000 for me by myself. For that you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
We begin tonight's episode with Carl Gottlieb, who penned the film's screenplay and portrayed the character of Meadows. Mr. Gottlieb is also the author of the groundbreaking book, The Jaws Log, his first-hand, in-depth exploration of the Jaws production. The Jaws Log has just been reissued in a brand new edition and is available wherever books are sold. In this conversation with Movie Geeks United correspondent Tony Farinella, Mr. Gottlieb discusses the Jaws phenomenon and the role it played in shaping the films we see today.
And my first question for you, Carl, is all these years later, Jaws is being released on Blu-ray, and your book is having an expanded edition. I open up the book by saying that you wish you knew what the magic formula was. With that said, how do you process what the film has meant to cinema and to yourself?
Well, it's one of the things that one has to get used to in show business is the fact that we don't tell audiences what they like, they tell us. I mean, you can kind of construct a popular entertainment using, you know, proven elements, but if we knew how to do it, we'd do it all the time. We'd never have flops. And yet,
right,
more flops than not. So when something becomes as iconic as Jaws, and I have one other iconic film in my writing repertoire, it was The Jerk with Steve Martin, you basically kind of accept it and smile and acknowledge your good fortune and also kind of accept the critical notions and the analyses that people do that basically tell you, oh, you know, what a good job you did after the fact. At the time you're doing it, you're just trying to do the best you can. And without knowledge or anticipation of the consequences.
I'm wondering, Carl, if there was a moment when you realized that the movie was a phenomenon.
Yeah, it was very early on. I mean, the first two paid previews, which were legitimate sneak previews in the old Hollywood sense that a paying audience had come to see an extra movie that they didn't know the title of, or they had no idea what it was they were going to be seeing. Two audiences in two different theaters, you know, half a country apart, one in Dallas, Texas, and one in Orange County in Lakewood, on a successive nights, the audience reaction couldn't be manufactured. It was
right.
Genuine enthrallment, you know, the buzz in the lobby after the show was, you know, I've heard it a few times in my life. I was in the movie MASH, and I went to a sneak preview of that in a Main Street, you know, downtown movie theater in San Francisco in 1969, and it was the same thing, you know, happened in the audience. The audience had gone to see Butch Cassidy and stayed to watch MASH, and the same, you know, the same reaction. A few times, Jerk, of course, and you know, a few other hits of friends of mine. I mean, the first Star Wars, it was screened for, you know, kind of a rock and roll, what you would now call a trendsetter audience, but it was
right.
screened on Hollywood Boulevard at a midnight show after the regular audience had left. It was a lot of, you know, actors and musicians and filmmakers, and we were in a big theater on Hollywood Boulevard. And, you know, the minute the first flyover of the spaceship after the crawl, from that shot on, you knew you were watching something special.
And you mentioned Star Wars, and it's very interesting because with Jaws, it's a movie that was credited with the advent of the blockbuster, which of course later solidified Star Wars. Many say it changed the tone of 70s cinema with its great success. Do you think that notion has any merit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the New Yorker this week did a very thoughtful revisiting, and the author of that points out that there was an earlier wide release. You know, the accepted wisdom is that Jaws was the first wide release in history. Not exactly right, but it was the first wide release of a hugely popular movie, and it set a distribution pattern which, you know, aside from, you know, artistic or aesthetic considerations, just the business model, the kind of thing you study at Wharton School of Finance and Commerce and Harvard Business School as a case study, that changed the business forever. You could argue today, you know, not for the best, but we're stuck with the pattern we have been globally for the last 35 years. I mean, over the last 35 years, I've been in Europe for numerous, you know, screenwriter convocations and industry events. And as a representative of Hollywood, I've had a lot of heat from I call them indigenous filmmakers, but you know, the French, the Spanish, the Swedes, Germany, you know, Italy, you know, all of which at one time had hugely thriving domestic film industries that are now, you know, subservient to blockbuster releases from the States. You know, when Jurassic Park opened on however many screens it opened in France, I was vilified in a public meeting. But in defense, I pointed out to the assembled Europeans that the American film industry grew up without a Ministry of Culture, without a state-supported film industry, without a national cinema or even a state radio and television network, which all the other countries enjoyed, where they had, if not a government monopoly, certainly a very strong national presence. But Hollywood never had that. It was always, you know, kind of pure laissez-faire capitalism with all the evils of monopoly management. And, you know, if you know your film history, I mean, block booking and the things that the Paramount Consent Decree ended in 1949 and, you know, a lot of issues. But we know about popular entertainments. We know how to do those, but probably better than anyone. So,
of course,
you know, we do.
Yep.
And I can't blame them for being angry. I mean, we used to see a lot of Swedish movies, considering the size of the nation and their output. Now, I mean, you can go years without seeing a good film from Sweden because they don't have a native industry anymore.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you mention all this because Hollywood in the 70s just seemed like, when you think of all the classic films that came out during that era, it's just endless, and there just seemed to be something going on with the filmmakers then, a certain creative energy, a passion, an art to it. What was it about that time that you think inspired such great film work?
It was a kind of a perfect storm of unrelated cultural events. There was the fallout from the 60s and the fact that popular culture was now being driven from the West Coast rather than the East. That was the first time in the history of American pop culture that that happened. In terms of the music, in terms of artistic freedoms, all of a sudden it wasn't New York, Boston, and Philadelphia, the literary axis. Those all became subservient to the rock and roll that was coming out of San Francisco and L.A. So there was a cultural wave where the influence of the coasts was flipped, number one. Number two, the studio system was undergoing an implosion of its own as a result of kind of clinging to outmoded models all through the 50s and 60s, kind of trying to deny that television existed and making, big screen family entertainments that bombed one after another. Dr. Doolittle, Fox was famous for them. There was an increase in the power of agents who began packaging in earnest and in ways that are now forbidden, but were pioneered by the guys at ICM and CAA and William Morris. So all of a sudden, filmmakers were getting more power and authority because the studios didn't know quite what to do. So they kind of released the reins a little. And then the success of Easy Rider, which provoked Peter Biskin's book, Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, which chronicles that whole period very well.
Right.
A lot of people who would not have been allowed to make movies earlier, or would have had to make them like John Cassavetes for low budgets and, small audiences, all of a sudden, once Easy Rider became a monster hit, that opened the doors for all the filmmakers who were standing in line waiting to get a chance, including Spielberg and Lucas and De Palma and Bert Schneider and Bob Rafelson, BBS and the Brits, and Brits coming up from behind. So it was a great time to be alive in Hollywood, I must say.
Oh, definitely. And it's funny that you mentioned that, too, because you watch these films from that era, and especially Jaws, and these films hold up incredibly well today, all these years later. I want to ask you about that with Jaws being on a Blu-ray. I want to ask you if you've had a chance to watch Jaws on Blu-ray and how you think the film was put together on Blu-ray and are you satisfied with it?
I haven't watched it on Blu-ray per se, but I've seen two beautifully projected prints that were struck from the same restored negative. So essentially, I've seen a digitally projected and a conventionally film projected version on prints, using the restored negative material. So, and it's a fabulous restoration. I mean, the color, the colors are, more balanced through the film than they've ever been. There's, great attention to to every corner of the frame, much less the foreground. There's a quality to the filmmaking that it's interesting you should notice because the fact that all those films, or a lot of films from the 70s hold up, is that they were all good stories in the Hollywood sense, in the same way you can look at Grapes of Wrath today, and everybody's dressed in little quaint Depression outfits, but that's, consistent with the period, so we buy it. And in Jaws, there was a interesting, work by everyone, and everyone on the visual side, from Joe Alves and all the production design people, not just the shark, but the look of the town, which I was just at for Jaws Fest, and Martha's Vineyard looks almost exactly the same. There's a timeless quality to the visuals, except for the fact that nobody's using a cell phone or texting. So when you look at the movie, you're kind of hard pressed to place it in time, which for a classic adventure story is perfect because it should either be in a specific historical period or future or the future, if we talk about the science fiction films. But there's a timeless quality in the visual design and of course the story. Can't knock the story.
No, no. And it's funny that we're talking about this, because my next question for you was, do you think that with the studio system and the way Hollywood is set up nowadays, do you think that you can make a film like Jaws today? And how would a film like Jaws today work?
Nope.
No?
You should excuse the expression. The shitheads at the studios are chasing some ephemeral vision of theirs of what constitutes a hit. And it's kind of like a guy watching a 100-yard dash and noticing that the winner is wearing red shorts. So he figures out, okay, if I put my runners in red shorts, they'll do faster times. You know, it's that kind of failure of perception and analysis to even know what a good story or a good film is, and to rely on special effects or pre-sold property, branding, as they call it now, which is why we have nothing but sequels, prequels, reboots, and adaptations. I mean, the studios, the people who are in charge of allocating these huge capital expenditures for films, are fearful that they have no eye. You know, they're tone deaf in their ears, and they confuse special effects with visual stimulation. And they, you know, set all their amplifiers at 11.
Yeah,
if you know that reference. It's short-sighted. You know, I don't think it'll mean the death of cinema, because the tools are getting so cheap that you don't have to be a big studio to make a theatrically projectable film on a professional standard. You don't need the resources of a studio anymore.
For distribution,
but if that logjam can be broken, if that stranglehold by the majors can be on distribution can be broken, we're in for a very pleasant revolution in filmmaking. But it requires that the dinosaurs either, you know, acknowledge that they're dinosaurs and you know, move aside for the little furry mammals who are coming up, or they just make better use of their power and size and influence and graze more productively on a public that wants to serve their financial interests. People want to pay for good entertainment, or they will pay for good entertainment, but the suits seem singularly tone-deaf and blind and unwilling to commit large sums on talent, and it's always been a talent-driven business. I mean, at the base, you're dealing with something very ephemeral, which is art.
Right.
Even pop art and pop culture. You know, it's kind of hard to track that stuff, and it's hard to, especially in Hollywood and London and Paris, it's hard to separate the bullshit artists from people who have genuine vision and who have real ability.
Yep.
And there's not a whole lot of reliance on people's opinion of scripts. People who read scripts are not the people who make investments.
Yep.
When was the last time a studio had read a script, unless it was by a writer for whom they paid $2 million to write it, so they kind of have to look at it because it's for the same reason that they would have to go look at a building that they spent $20 million on
Just
to see if the roof doesn't leak. But, if you write a script, and any of your readers write scripts, the gatekeepers are peers and contemporaries who are, you know, basically hanging on to jobs, reading scripts for $20, trying to avoid making a commitment because a positive commitment to a failed project is a sure ticket out of the business. I love this business. I would love to see it succeed. And it just pains me to see so much money spent where the same amount of money spent even on three films instead of one film would support, you know, a lot more creative work.
That's so interesting you mentioned this, because to me it seems like from what you're talking about and from what I've gathered just as, you know, watching film and being a huge fan of film, it seems like a lot of the screenplays that are written today are really dumbing things down for the audience. And I think the audience wants more and expect more. What do you think about the state of screenwriting in that sense, in terms of some of the screenplays, I guess, being dumbed down for audiences?
Well, there's a saying in the business that movies are not written, they're rewritten. It's interesting. There's still a large percentage of movies that are basically produced you know, as written, or with you know, with some writer, some modifications, maybe one or two writers, but you know, the Writers Guild does arbitrations on screen credits, and you know, 50% or 60% or 70%—I don't know what the current number is. Used to be 80% of film credits are uncontested. Everybody says, "Yeah, that's who wrote the movie," and they go on and they put it out. On the big films where there is so much at stake, it is current fashion to use writers like Kleenex and keep, you know, trying to wipe the nose of the script, and without curing the cold. and this goes back to my answer to the last question. If more producers and directors trusted the material, because every time, you know, the scripts that get made have a quality to them. You can read them, you go, okay, I can see this being a very good movie. And then when somebody tells you, oh, and Tommy Lee Jones is going to play the guy, or, you know, Adam Sandler, for God's sake, or you know, pick a name, and you go, you know what, that would be a really good choice. Kristen Chenoweth is going to be the girl. You go, well, great fucking choice, you know. And then the movie gets better and better. If more people would, like, read a good script and say, you know what, can we just more or less shoot this the way it's written, without a director's ego all over it, without, you know, there's going to be, I tell writing students, there's at least three versions of a script for every movie that's made. There's the script that got bought and put into production, you know, the sales version of the script. There's the script that was adapted for to satisfy the elements, you know, big visuals put in to make a director happy, a long, you know, speech or a series of eloquent speeches were put in to satisfy actors, and then the third version of the script is some practical editing of the previous two versions, which actually results in a shooting script that everybody can live with, that where the actors feel properly served. The director says, I can do my work on this story, and contributes all that a director contributes to a film. And either a writer or the writers can say, you know, I'm not going to get involved in an egocentric battle over screen credit. You know, whoever, there's a saying, you know, there's no limit to what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit. And sadly, in our business, there's too much money tied to screen credit so that a writer with less than clean hands will work on a script thinking ahead to the production bonus and his participation in the revenue stream downstream, and will change a script just for the sake of change to make it more his or her own. Without consideration for the story or the plot or the characters or anything else. And that, and you know, if a director and a producer, if a spineless studio and an egocentric director collaborate in that process, you get a film that's much less than it could have been.
Yeah. And my final question for you, Carl, is what does Jaws mean to you today?
Oh, you know, when you work in the popular arts, the most that you can hope for is some version of immortality, in that your work becomes part of the collective consciousness of your culture, or with luck, a global culture. And Jaws did that. I mean, you know, there's lines of dialogue that are, you can say anywhere in the world. You can hum the tune. You can go da-dum, da-dum, dum-dum-dum-dum, and everybody knows what you're talking about. And it's after the fact. You know, I didn't plan it that way. Even Spielberg didn't plan it that way. All he knew is he needed a commercial hit that year.
Right.
But after the fact, and remember, we're all a genius after the fact.
Of course.
After the fact, the being a part of something that has been absorbed by popular culture and remains iconic, you know, that's as good as you can do in this business, and you know, I'm happy for that. I'm happy for the film. Just a quick sidebar. This has nothing to do with our conversation, except
sure.
the cultural icon part. a television writer named Treva Silverman, who wrote Mary Tyler Moore Show and was very, very successful mm-hmm. early on, one of the first great women television comedy writers, mm-hmm. was a strictly a New York, Beverly Hills person, you know, migrated from Broadway to Hollywood and back, you know, just. And then one year she decided to get off the plane at Denver, rent a car, and see the middle of the country, the people that she'd always, you know, there'd always been flyover people. She knew they were important.
Right.
She knew the importance of Nielsen ratings. She had worked on the most popular shows on television. But she was interested to see what it was like out there, because just personally she had no experience of America. So she got off the plane, and before she could by the time she had picked up her luggage at the carousel, people had thrown lines of popular TV show dialogue at her. In the course of the stewardess said, sorry about that, which was a line that she had written for Get Smart. And they were quoting lines from, dialogue that she had written or her colleagues had written in the writers' rooms for these popular television shows. Everybody was speaking in those cliches. It had entered the culture. She got back on the plane and fled to Hollywood, saying to her friends in the writers' room, "Oh my God, do you realize we tell them what to say? What would they do if they didn't have television dialogue to imitate? How would they talk?" Genuinely confused.
It reminds me of the Peter Sellers movie, Be In There, where the person is just so used to television and pop culture that they don't start in the real world. It's like they don't know how to live outside of it.
Yeah. If 25 and under generation didn't have Saturday Night Live and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, you wonder what would they talk about? Or how, not even what. Because I'm sure they would talk about the same thing, but how would those conversations be framed without the catchphrases and the pop references?
"I pulled a tooth the size of a shot glass out of the wreck hull of a boat out there, and it was the tooth of a great white.
It was Ben Gardner's boat. It was all chewed up. I helped tow it in. You should have seen him."
Where is that tooth? Did you see it, Broden?
No, I didn't see it. He dropped it.
I had an accident.
On the way in.
And what did you say the name of this shark is?"
"It's a Carcharodon and Carcharias. It's a great white."
"But you don't have the tooth. Look, we depend on the summer people here for our very lives.
You are not going to have
a summer. If you close those
beaches,
we're finished.
We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark. I mean, we're going to have to tell the Coast Guard.
Mr. Gordon,
we're going
to have to contact the shark.
We're going to have to put extra deputies on because
you have to ring the world entire harbor.
I don't think
one of you are familiar with our problems.
I think that I am familiar with the fact that you are going to ignore this particular problem until it swims up and bites you on the ass. Now, wait a second. There are two ways to deal with this problem. You're either going to kill this animal, or you're going to cut off its food supply."
"Larry, we have to close the beaches."
The makers of The Shark Is Still Working first appeared on our program way back in July of 2007. Jaws fans have been salivating for a glimpse of their film for years, as it features original interviews with all the key creatives involved in the film, insights from a generation of filmmakers who count Jaws as their major source of cinematic inspiration, and narration by none other than star Roy Scheider. It's been a long, hard-fought journey, but through perseverance and passion, this talented group of filmmakers / Jaws fanatics have finally realized their collective dream, as their documentary is unleashed upon the masses as a featured extra on the new Jaws Blu-ray release. In this segment, we revisit The Shark Is Still Working with three key members of the production: producer James Gillette, director Eric Hollander, and co-producer and composer Michael McCormick. Michael's score for the documentary, which you've been hearing throughout this show, is available for purchase through his website at michaelmccormickmusic.com, Amazon, eBay, CD Baby, and through jawstribute.com. This has been such a long process, and then the victory of finally receiving word that you'll be included in the Jaws Blu-ray restoration package. Did it feel like victory, like you had reached the finish line? I want to hear your thoughts on that from each of you, starting with you, James.
Well, it was a mixture of a lot of things. Because, I mean, you've been following us since the very beginning. You know what the progress was like and the kind of momentum we had for a while and the kind of publicity we were getting. And it looked like we were really a big deal for a while. And of course, that was a very exciting time. And then we hit a lot of different walls that slowed us down. And it made the Sharkist working feel more like a burden than a labor of love, which it originally was. So when we finally got this news, it was a mixture of a lot of things. I think the first feeling that at least I felt was one of relief. You know, the fact that it ended up being included in the Jaws Blu-ray, that's probably the only thing, the only outcome that could have made all that waiting and all that suffering worthwhile. I mean, you really couldn't ask for a better place to hang that project for any of us, just because the whole point of what we were trying to do was celebrate this movie that we love so much, and now we get to, you know, quote-unquote, officially be attached to it for all the world to see. So, to put it in a nutshell, I'd say, a mixture of relief and a mixture of victory.
Did you feel the same way, Eric?
I got to be honest. There was probably towards the end there was much more of a feeling of relief than just the raw thrill, simply because this thing really took its toll on all of us in different ways. I mean, here's five people that have been trying for 7 years to get this thing out. I mean, we felt like we had built, you know, an orca in the basement, and we couldn't move it, you know. And so, you know, towards the end of my sixth year in the trenches on this thing, I just pretty much had a meltdown, Spielberg-esque meltdown, truth be told. And so, you know, really, the other four guys, Michael Roddy and James Gillette and Jake Gove and Michael McCormick, man, they all kind of came in and championed the cause. It was like I felt like I had this monkey in my back for so long, it just was too much weight. And they really kind of ushered it down the path, and I was kind of out of the loop, frankly. I really didn't know, nor did I want to know, really, what was going on. You know, they honored my kind of need at that time, for which I'm very grateful to all of them. But so relief, yeah, definitely relief, number one. But yeah. I got to be honest, man, I'm now that it's kind of sinking in, and I think the surrealness of this thing, it has caused an adrenaline rush where you're kind of numb to what's going on. I mean, you're thrilled, but you don't quite know how to feel. But now that it is finally sinking in how significant this is, and so the thrill is starting to overtake the relief.
Yeah.
Short answer.
So Mike, tell me where you how you found out that you'd be included in the package and what feelings you went through.
Oh, well, I'll never forget. I was driving to work, and Michael Roddy gave me a call, and you know, he told me it's coming out. It's going to be on the Blu-ray, and I told him, you know, you have a friend for life. Basically, I was just so happy, I'm just very grateful to all the other guys. You know, Jake Gove for helping us get started. James and Eric, of course, for help constructing it, and Michael Roddy for helping get it to the finish line and get it started as well. So I just feel grateful, and I'm very grateful to Universal for including it on the Jaws Blu-ray, and Steven Spielberg, too. I mean, he's had to have seen it at some point and gave it the thumbs up. And it's just so nice that, because after a while, you know, like the guys were saying, it was a bit of a, it started weighing on us a little bit, and we really had to pull each other through. And it's our love for the movie, and just after a while, though, we felt an obligation to the fans that wanted to see this, and also an obligation to all the cast and crew that were passing away. Mm. You know, here we were. We had these guys. We lost Roy, Percy Rodriguez, David Brown, recently even Richard Zanuck, and Peter Benchley also passed away. So here we are with this footage of these great people, and we can't get it out. People want to see it. The memory of these folks and the members that are still alive need to be out there, and we need to celebrate this movie. So it's just so nice to be able to share it with all the Jaws fans, and it's incredibly surreal.
I can't believe we're talking about it. But really, as far as the way we feel, we're just grateful. And I'm grateful to you as well, because you guys were a big help in helping us get the word out.
There is a feature alive today that has survived more than three decades of motion picture evolution without change, without question, and without equal. It lives to thrill, a timeless cinematic classic. It still attracts and captivates millions. It is as if Hollywood created the perfect motion picture experience and called it Jaws.
I want to know what that endeavor was like when you guys first started. What, I mean, we know where it's ultimately been included in this Blu-ray, but what was the initial hope or path for this film as you guys envisioned it when you first started going on this journey?
Let me say this. First of all, in relation to it coming out on the Blu-ray, it is truly the culmination of all our hopes and dreams from the beginning. You know, we in our naivete, we thought, you know, Universal, how can they pass on this? I mean, we've got Spielberg, we've got Scheider narrating it, we've got, you know, Peter Benchley's last interview, and just on and on. And it just, there were so many reasons why we couldn't imagine Universal wouldn't want to get their hands on it. And, you know, the reality sets in that, you know, they had plans to eventually release Jaws on Blu-ray, which they were going to do with the 100th anniversary, which, again, is another honor. I mean, it's huge, even just in that regard. But you know, if the question I kept getting asked all the time, and I'm sure the other guys did too, was, you know, when is this thing going to get released? Why don't you put it out? And we kept, you know, why isn't Universal? People were almost vilifying Universal as if it was their fault. And I would say, listen, if Jaws isn't even on their plate right now, why would a documentary about the movie be on their plate? So it's not Universal's fault. It was never Universal's fault. They have a strategy. They're a corporation. They know what they're doing. So we would just say, look, you know, if they're ever going to pick it up, it's going to be when they release Jaws, if we're ever that fortunate. And, of course, it ends up panning out that way, but for a long time, we didn't know. So our original idea for this was, we used to fantasize openly about it, you know, wouldn't it be great if this thing got released on a Blu-ray release of Jaws? And we made a lot of assumptions that just bear out our naivete. But thankfully, it worked out.
Well, it's the perfect outlet. I mean, it's the ideal outlet for it. I mean, you have, obviously, a completely captive audience that you know was absolutely ravenous for Jaws. And so it's the perfect format in which for them to view your documentary. This is what I was curious about, James, too. You know, it's kind of like the show. When we started the show, it was just movie fans sitting around talking, and then it kind of kept mushrooming into something grander. Did that kind of define this project for you guys when you first got started and you started rolling with all of these guests?
Well, yeah, our original idea for the documentary was very small. It was pretty much only going to be, I think in November of 2004, Eric and I were invited to be a part of, you know, Jaws Fest, the upcoming Jaws Fest 05, which, of course, has been well-publicized over the years. They just had another one. And right around the same time, Roddy was hired as the creative director of Jaws Fest. Eric and I, we had the idea, we've been working on documentaries together for about 10 years, and we were suddenly between projects and not knowing what to do, and we had just watched another documentary that some friends of ours had done. We weren't that impressed with the documentary itself, but we were very impressed with these guys who had no experience, just had an idea, and they saw it to the end and just had the wherewithal to ride an idea out. And Eric says, man, we need to do something that's our own. Because everything we'd ever worked on before that was we were hired by somebody else to do. It was like somebody else's project, and those projects usually had some kind of social or current events act to grind. And we wanted to do something that would A, be ours, and B, be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric said, what can we do? And I said, well, we got the perfect project, you know, right up our alley coming around, and it's, you know, we're going to be at the Jaws Fest, and let's do something about Jaws Fest. And that was all it was going to be. It was going to be about just that thing. We kind of envisioned it as a Trekkies for Jaws fans. You know, with James Michael Roddy on board, who had, you know, worked a lot of years with Universal, he convinced us that we could think bigger. And he was right. He got us a lot of, you know, he got us Spielberg and Dreyfuss and a lot of the interviews that suddenly made us seem like a big deal, you know. And once that happened, once we got those first few big names, it seemed like everything else just kind of started coming to us.
It's like
we couldn't stop it from getting bigger at that point. It was getting bigger. It was like the blob, you know. No matter what we did, it just kept on growing before our very eyes. Yeah, just like your show. And I remember the very first time we went on your show, you know, the size and scope of your show at the time. I remember at the end of that year, you guys said that having the Sharkest Working guys, that was the highlight of our entire year. And now look at my goodness, the who's who of people that are on your show is massively impressive.
Well, I appreciate that. But, I mean, you've been with us from almost the very beginning, so we feel like you guys are just part of our family. You're in the DNA of the show since you've been there from the start. But tell me, how did you know when you were finished, when you had actually completed the film and there was nothing else you needed to get for it?
Well, as far as the 7 years that go by, and you could probably say the same thing. I think Movie Geeks has gone probably about 7-8 years at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You continue to work on your skill level, try to get better as you go. And I think that really happened, if I may say so, Eric. I do think I became a better musician over time because I continue to work on it and put more and more into it. But I think as far as filmmakers, and James did a good portion of the editing on The Shark Is Still Working, along with Eric. But I think over time we got better at what we wanted to convey with the documentary. And so over time, portions of it were cut down, things that we didn't need were cut out. And so there are various versions of the documentary. Of course, we would release, we would do a release. No one asked us to put the, you know, to make this documentary. So if there was an opportunity to show it somewhere or get it as a part of a film festival just to get the word out so people will know we exist, you know, we would put it out at various levels of production, not saying, well, this is the end cut, this is the finished product, but just to get it out there so people can see it and know about it. But I think ultimately, and I spent a lot of time with Eric in September, 2010. We got it ready for a screening at Pixar, and there was a lot of rescoring involved. And Eric sat down with it and just started working some magic there. And we got it to a point, because we were getting feedback, you know, it's hard to sit through the whole thing in one sitting and whatnot. But Eric really sat down and really just applied everything that he had learned in that time. And I really did, too, with the music that I was putting into it on that last cut. And I just felt like when we sat back and we watched it, we just felt like this is it right here. We're pretty happy with this. Of course, there were some other minor changes later on, but I just think there was an evolution over 7 years you would hope there would be, where we just kind of got a little better at what we were doing, and that's why we're really happy with what ended up making the Blu-ray.
So Eric, tell me in your words where you think it was years ago, and what you think the movie is now on the Jaws Blu-ray.
Well, like Mike said, I mean, you know, this thing went through many incarnations. The original version we had was a little over 3 hours, and it was pretty much designed to be strictly a DVD watch. And, you know, we would send screeners out, and, you know, you have your diehard fans that want to get every little, you know, tidbit of trivia that they can about the film. And that's who we would send them to. I mean, people who were real Jaws fans. So, you know, the reviews were very good. Rotten Tomatoes, a lot of critics that we'd sent screeners to gave it a fresh rating. That's why we have got this like perfect score there. But it was, you know, a lot of people that just loved the movie and loved this stuff that we were finding that nobody else had ever talked about. And then as we got a little further in, we started realizing just you know, like Mike said, you do learn more about, you know, what the industry folks call killing your babies. I mean, there's stuff in there that I had to be honest with and say, you know, this means a lot to me because I know this person or I know this situation or I was there, but it's just not going to have mass appeal. And so we would trim a little here and there, and James and I had many disagreements on some things. And it was a really good iron sharpening iron situation with us because, you know, he'd be sitting over my shoulder. We'd be making these decisions together, and I would defer to him half the time, and he would defer to me, and sometimes it got a little hot, but at the end of the day, it was a great, great method for us. And mm-hmm. as a result, we shortened it, eventually got it down to 2 hours, 20 minutes, which I was very happy with that cut. And we took it out. We had the premiere in L.A. We showed it. It was sold out theater there, and you know, people had traveled from different states to come in. People had heard about this for already 2 or 3 years, so they came out there, and we had Carl Gottlieb and Joe Alves and Jeffrey Kramer and Bill and Michael Chapman were all on stage, so they spoke some. Then the movie played. Well, 2 hours and 20 minutes is not bad for a DVD supplement, but for a captive audience in a theater, even the diehard Jaws fans that were there, we're getting a little, you know, tired. And it was late. The show was running late as it was, and there were two shows planned. So what happened was at the end of the at the thing, we had question-answer session, and not many people were able to stay because we had to get the next group in. And it felt like the overwhelming comments that we got, the feeling that we got from the people who came to see it was just, it's really good, we really liked it, but it's just too long. And, of course, I'm thinking, you know, yeah, for a screening it's too long. But it never was designed for a screening. It's just we're showing it because this is right now the only way we can do it. So, you know, it was a little discouraging, but there were no negative comments about the content. So I felt like we hit all the right marks. But then over time we had to cut it down again, and there were different strategies and different marketing opportunities that we were seeking. And we ended up cutting it down, you know, significantly, like 40 minutes. And then we finally got word that Steven Spielberg had seen it, and he was enthusiastic. He liked it, but he had a few changes himself. And he said, you know, the sequel section got to go. The couple lines in there that he just wasn't in favor of those being in there. And, of course, you do it. You change it. You don't question it. You don't, you know, you just do it.
Yeah, when Spielberg gives you notes, I...
when Spielberg directs you, you just do it.
right.
And honestly, I think the changes are... The doc is better for those changes, truly. But, you know, as a result of those, and then many other little addendums and rearranging some of the sections, it was in a totally different order at certain parts. But when you cut out full sections or full, you know, little themes in it, the segues don't work like they did. So you've got to rearrange it and try to tie in the stuff. And in some ways, in some respects, I think it's not as there aren't as good a segues in between some segments as there was before. But in other ways, they're better in other sections. So it was just a trade-off, you know. At the end of the day, we're happy, very happy. Mike came in, and after just really, really earning his stripes as co-producer, because he really pushed this thing when it was going through a very difficult uphill battle to get this thing out there. And he came in and basically scored the whole thing originally. So his music took us out of any danger of copyright infringement with Williams, but at the same time, it added a very unique flair to the doc. So it doesn't come off as just borrowing like every other documentary tends to do.
Right.
Well, like Michael said the other day, he was on a show, and I love what he said, and he's true. a lot of times when you see documentaries done that rely on independent sources, because they don't want to pay the rates for John Williams' score, they tend to kind of ape the Jaws theme, and they try to make it sound like Jaws, but not really. And Mike opted to just do a totally new approach and not come off as trying to, you know, mimic the Jaws theme with that extra note that sounds cheesy and everybody, you know, it just comes off as kind of chintzy. So I love that approach.
That's, I do too. And, yeah. And actually, watching the documentary again the other day, as it's presented on the Blu-ray, I mean, it's essentially, it's wall-to-wall music. And your score is just phenomenal, my friend. It really is. And I'm wondering about the challenges of not aping the original Jaws music, obviously, but kind of paying honor to that feeling of that Williams score. Tell me about how that worked for you.
Well, kind of like what I was saying before, you know, we just kind of got better at things, and we just continued to work and study. I actually, at one point, after I'd done an original pass on the Shark, a lot of it was electronic music, and a lot of that was just from, well, we've heard this in other documentaries, that's probably what we should go with. And I really wasn't at a point early on to support something that sounds symphonic, at least in a halfway realistic manner. But there finally came a point where I was like, well, look, I'm going to go study. I went and studied with a guy named Stephen Scott Smalley, who's an orchestrator. He's worked with Basil Poledouris, Jerry Goldsmith, and Danny Elfman, folks like that. And he came through Nashville, and I went and studied with him for a while. And I just wanted to learn as much as I could about movement and just more of a synthetic, organic approach is what I would call it, where we're using technology, but we're trying to make it sound as organic as possible. And as far as my approach with the score, it's like I really miss – I don't know, I'm sure you might feel the same way. I just really miss those big themes that we used to get, you know, especially from John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, John Barry, guys like that. Just really big, soaring themes. You know, I think of the Superman theme when I think of Williams as just an extraordinary score. Of course, we've got Jaws 2 that Williams did. But I really wanted to do something that captured that kind of spirit, something that has a melody, and hopefully, you know, it's up to the viewer to decide its merit, but I really hope it does honor the project, because the last thing I wanted to do was, you know, shortchange fans with something that's like, you know, well, how many times have you heard in some documentary or some Jaws ripoff, you know, where they invert the Jaws notes, and it's like, you know what they do. You can't
exactly. Yeah, that's what's so terrific about the score too, and also something I noticed is that how many kind of emotions your score is able to hit upon, because the documentary covers a lot of ground, so you can have a foreboding sound, a thrilling sound, a lively sound, a very respectful kind of memoriam tribute sound for those that have passed. I mean, you give musical voice to all of that, so it's a very diverse score, too, I found.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I mean, all I can say is there's 7 years of work in there.
Yeah.
And I loved this movie so much, and there was a point where, you know, I'm with these guys, and I'm just giving everything I've got to this project, you know, but even if I was some big shot, you know, like Hans Zimmer, and I can choose my projects, if someone told me they were making a documentary about Jaws, man, that's the first thing I'd go for. So in my eyes, it's all downhill from here, because, you know, this is the greatest movie ever made. It's just a blessing to be able to be involved with this. And as we were talking before about, you know, how does it feel? It's completely surreal. I can't believe this has happened, but I do have the memory of just sitting as long as it took and putting everything I had, every bit of heart into that score to try to give myself at least something that I'll remember for the rest of my life. And I hope the score will stand the test of time. And I just,
I appreciate your kind words about it. That's great. I do want to give one bit of recognition also to a guitarist that plays on the two end title tracks, Show Me the Way to Go Home and Spanish Ladies. That's the lead guitar that you hear on those tracks is Greg Parker, who's a tremendously talented guitarist that's in Nashville, Tennessee, and he does audio production. He also helped tie in a lot of the audio issues that we were having with the documentary and really smoothing things out. So I just want to be sure and recognize Greg Parker for his contributions on both the sound to the documentary and the soundtrack.
Absolutely. Now, I know that we covered this years ago, the last time you guys were on the show, but it's always fun to revisit. When you think back on the myriad of great people that you spoke to about Jaws for your documentary, I want to know a high point for you, kind of a most memorable moment from that experience. James, if you want to start out.
Well, it's hard to say, anyone other than Spielberg. we're talking about an entire lifetime of not just loving Jaws, but every single movie he ever did. I mean, those are the ones that we grew up on. I mean, for someone my age and the age of the other guys, it's pretty much Star Wars and Spielberg when you were a kid. Finally getting a chance to meet him, it's just truly a remarkable thing. And it exceeded our expectations in every possible way. Not was it just, hey, I get to be in the same room as Steven Spielberg, but he was giving us quality time. I mean, he was just a giver that day. Right down to, adding John Williams to the moment, which was something that blew us completely by surprise. But, here he is. I mean, he's possibly one of the most powerful guys in Hollywood right now, and he couldn't have been more regular with us. I mean, we could have just gone out to lunch and just geeked out talking about movies that day instead of conducting a two-hour interview, and he would have been exactly the same.
Was he a difficult interview to kind of to get at first? Was he hesitant to talk about the Jaws experience at all?
I don't believe so. I mean, that's what we had heard. The reputation that he had regarding Jaws in the years leading up to that was he was tired of Jaws and didn't like reliving those memories because so many of those memories were bad ones. That was the impression that we were all under. But Michael Roddy was pursuing him anyway and just utilizing the connections that he had that might be able to make an interview with him happen, and it happened. As a matter of fact, we just happened to already be in Los Angeles, and he showed us his phone saying, okay, you have such and such period of time. Actually, I think it was Eric, refresh my memory. Was it you have two... Or no, you have Spielberg from 4 to 6, and it immediately we were thinking it was you have him from 4 to 6 minutes, but it was like from 4 to 6 p.m. is how that went down, and he, like wow, it actually happened. It really, really happened.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Eric, how about you? What was the highlight for you?
I don't want to parrot James. That's pretty much what I think as well. But I have to say another one of the supreme highlights was Roy Scheider. We had, he was the number one A-lister that we got. I mean, the top dog. And when we met him, Michael Roddy and I had been to the Vineyard and we met James, and it was this kind of crazy adventure that we had to go through just to get to the Hamptons in time to do the interview. And it was just a fantastic time. Again, like Spielberg, he welcomed us into his home. He's giving us root beers. He's just shooting the breeze. And of course, we're just in awe of this man. We're in his living room, and he's letting us rearrange his furniture and set up the interview however we want. And it was just not only a great time, with another human being doing an interview, but it was just, I mean, this is Roy Scheider. This is our childhood hero. This is the star of the film, one of the stars, let me say. And then that continued, a little over a year later. I don't know how long it was after that, but when we did the narration sessions at Studio 9, was it New Studio 9? Is that what it was called?
Or 51.
9 East, or anyway, whatever it was.
Yes, that's right. 91 East.
91 East, yeah. And it was near his house. I mean, so it was very convenient for him. And you know, we went into, we had to finish script, and we go in there, and we had allotted, he'd allotted maybe, I don't know, 3-4 hours. And upon doing this, you know, actually doing the narration, we start realizing, oh, my word, this thing is not going to get done today. I mean, it was just far bigger of a challenge. We had all his bits were in yellow highlight, and so he's doing the best he can. It's getting kind of late, and we just were, oh, boy. We were a little nervous, and then finally at the end of the day, he just said, look, guys, I can't do it. I'm kind of at the end. And but he graciously just said, look, we'll finish it tomorrow. And he left, and next day came in. He was all refreshed, sat down. He was amazing. Sat and had a lunch break with him, and it was just an incredible experience as a Jaws fan to be sitting there with this guy and have him, you know, after he did the narration, you know, he wasn't out the door. He wanted to sit and talk a little about it, and I'll never forget, he said something like, you know, I feel certain Universal will eventually want this. They'll want it because you have everybody.
Yeah.
He said, you know, they're going to want you to cut it down, I'm sure. They'll want changes and stuff. Of course, we didn't know how true that was ultimately to be. But then he said, you know, guys, I have a feeling you're going to have to make a lot of changes. So you just call me. I'm ready to do any changes you want. And left it at that. And you know, we spoke to him a few times on the phone afterwards before he passed away, and he was always a very staunch supporter of us. Let us drop his name. And when Spielberg asked, you know, who have you got? You know, the first person out of our mouth said, well, Roy Scheider. And he just lent incredible veracity to what we're doing. And
mm-hmm.
And just a credibility that bought us a lot of favor with the other, you know, big guys. And of course, Zanuck also, this is a funny anecdote. I want to get this in before we get too far off the mothership. But basically, Zanuck had agreed to do the interview with us. And this was after we had done the one with Spielberg and Williams. And after he had agreed to do it, he started getting cold feet. He started thinking, you know, I agreed to do this thing, and I don't know who these guys are. So he ends up calling Mr. Spielberg and says, listen, I think I might have made a mistake. I just agreed to do this interview for these guys, and I don't know, should I do it? And apparently Spielberg was just jumped right on and said, hey, listen, guys, do it. These guys are great. I did it. It's awesome. Trust me, you'll be glad you did it. And so he told us that when we got there. And, you know, how do you respond to that? You know, you have Spielberg going to bat for us. He didn't know us, you know. But this was the kind of serendipity we constantly were running into in the early stages of this thing. And I got to say, man, you know, as a fan of the film, because that's what we are. We're five fans. We're not first and foremost professional documentarians. I mean, we've done this work before. I mean, James and I have a lot of experience in documentary work prior to this. But at the end of the day, we put on our fan hats to make this thing. And with borrowed equipment and rented, you know, I mean, it was basically at the time there were four producers before Michael came on as co-producer, but we funded this thing out of our eight pockets, you know. And then, of course, Michael ended up putting in his own money for the later stages of this thing. So all of us bled over this thing, really. It was
mm-hmm.
a complete team effort. But just to have experienced all of this was truly like the Jaws fanboy dream come true. But, you know, in later years when all the difficulties arose, everything from legal issues to you name it, you know, it there was a trade-off, which basically ate my lunch. But at the end of the day, I really wouldn't change any of it. I think it's made us all, it's taught us all a lot of lessons. It's given us memories we'll cherish the rest of our lives. And, you know, I hope it's humbled us something. But I'll tell you, man, you know, in the words of Wayne and Garth, man, we're not worthy. I mean, to be on the Jaws Blu-ray is just a supreme honor.
Michael, I actually wanted to give you a chance to respond to the most memorable moment of the production of this.
Well, for me, of course, you had us on previously, and it was right after Roy passed away, and I was talking about getting to talk to him. Michael Roddy let me talk to him, and Eric put him on the phone, and it was as he was dealing with his cancer treatment. My mother was sick at the same time, and I said it then, and I say it now. I'll never forget him telling me, you know, showing a sincere interest in my mother's health, and telling me, you know, in that Roy Scheider voice, send your mother my love and save some of that love for yourself. Like, that's just, I can't believe, I mean, Roy Scheider was my hero, so I've watched him kill sharks many, many thousands of times when I was a kid. But you know, as far as the greatest thing to take away from it is isn't so much meeting or talking with famous people. I mean, that's great. And I'm sure you experienced this with your show as well. But the greatest thing is just the friends you make along the way.
Yeah.
And with the Sharks still working, I mean, I'll say that all their names. Of course, we've got Eric Hollander, James Gillette, Michael Roddy, and Jake Gove, who actually started JawsMovie.com, which is basically the genesis of the whole Jaws online community. But having those guys, we've been through so much together. We're almost like brothers at this point. So we will butt heads, but we'll be friends at the end of the day. And I think just going through all this stuff has bonded us, and I hope I can speak for everybody that we will have lasting friendships. It was so great being with James and Eric at Jaws Fest a couple weeks ago. But there's other friends that I've met, like you, Jamie, and Rick Jansen, who was kind enough to make an ad for me, didn't ask anything. Well, of course, I did score one of his films, Lamppost Lane. But he made me a commercial that's on YouTube now that I appreciate so much. And making friends like Rick, or just meeting the occasional fan that's excited about the documentary or excited about the soundtrack, and just being able to share this with other people and know you're not the only person that's watched, you know, Quentin get eaten hundreds of times. It's just been a great experience, just making friends and being able to talk with other people about this great movie.
Universal definitely has an intense commitment to preservation and restoration of its film library. The restoration of Jaws is a tremendous responsibility.
Centennial Project is Universal Pictures' 100th anniversary. We are releasing 100 of our titles, 13 of our classic titles are being fully restored on a film level.
In the case of Jaws, this is history, culture.
Hold up! What's exciting about this digital age, where we're able to restore these movies, we can bring these classic movies back to life in a way that makes them more vivid than even we remember them when we went to the cinema to see them.
Obviously, you've lived with it for so long, you've watched it hundreds of times, but now you have this beautifully restored version of the movie itself. Tell me the experience of seeing it just completely restored like that, James. What was that like?
It's like looking through a window. It looks so good, right?
Yes, it really does. It's fantastic.
It just twinkles. I mean, the fact that there is actually technology that is, you know, able to take a movie that's that old and you know, whose appearance has deteriorated as much as it has over the years, and be able to make it look like that it boggles the mind. That they actually can make that happen. And kudos to, I mean, I wish I knew enough about the restoration process to be able to name people by name. I know there was a team of people, whatever their names are, every single one of them deserves credit for really not cutting any corners, not cutting a single solitary corner, but looking at every frame painstakingly. You know they did in great detail. Were extremely patient, and they made sure they did it right. I mean, Jaws is definitely the kind of movie where that type of restoration, it needs to be done right, and they hit the ball out of the friggin' park, I mean, times X. I've watched the Blu-ray twice, and it's you know, I just my mouth is hanging open the whole time. There are times that it feels like the first time.
Seeing it
really is fresh. I'm seeing details and hearing details I've never known were there, which is what a treat. If, like you said, if you love the movie and you've grown up on it and you have watched it hundreds of times, which I have, and then being able to discover brand new things that have always been there but you've never noticed them, that's a cool treat.
That's it for this episode of Movie Geeks United. You can purchase the newly restored Jaws anywhere Blu-rays are sold, and you can also pick up Michael McCormick's soundtrack to The Shark Is Still Working at his official website at michaelmccormickmusic.com, amazon.com, eBay, cdbaby.com, and at jawstribute.com.
The world went on due to you, fast Spanish ladies. The world went on due to you, ladies of Spain. Oh, we received orders for the sail back to Boston. And so nevermore shall we see you.
Nevermore shall we see you again. And so nevermore shall we see you again.